Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 307. And we're live tonight on Odyssey, DLive, Rumble, and Entropy. And because I'm banned from everywhere except for Telegram and Gab, please do give this show a little share if you can, because I struggle to share it outside of those platforms. So if you can do that, that would be greatly appreciated. So if you're on X, if you're on Facebook, if you're on Instagram, if you're on any of the places which I'm permanently banned from thanks to the UK government and the Home Office, please do help the word spread. And we've got a great guest for you tonight who you will see here on screen now, and I'll be introducing him shortly. But before I do that, I'll just tell you what I'm up to for the rest of the week. On Friday, I will be back with David Duke at 4 p.m. On Friday, I'll also be producing, which I'm currently writing and editing at the moment, but it's a pre-recorded video about the situation Marine Le Pen has faced. And that's going to be quite interesting because I've talked about other groups that have either faced bans or candidates that have faced being barred, who have actually had major parliamentary representation in Europe. And it's basically about democracy and how democracy is nothing but an illusion. And if the people vote for the wrong candidate, it's like going into the casino and thinking you're going to win. The game is rigged and it's very hard to win, even if you do sell out, such as Marine Le Pen has. So that'll be out on Friday at the usual time. Then on Sunday, we'll be back for the Nationalist A Team. Myself, Patriot, and Natty will be live here on Odyssey at 7 p.m. So there's all that to look forward to later in the week. And finally, if you want to contribute to this stream, if you want to ask a question, if you want to make a point, or if you want to just donate, please do send a super chat. You can still do that via Odyssey. You can also do that on Rumble, and you can do it through Entropy. All the links are there for you to do that. And if you want to send something, $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford, it'll be greatly appreciated, because that is the way I keep my head above water. Nothing I do goes behind a paywall. I don't generate income via having some website where I can take memberships or anything like that. I don't do that. Everything that I earn is done through these streams. So if you could please consider giving a small donation, that would be greatly appreciated. And any questions to myself or to Ron Unz will be put to us both in the second hour of the show. Now, you can also send money via cryptocurrency. All the crypto links are in the description below. You can give via Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Monero. And if you don't see the crypto you want to donate in, you can always send me an email. And anyone can send me an email at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. You can contact me there if you need help, if you need advice, or if you've got feedback about the show, or if you'd like to get involved in any form of real life activism. And that's it, really. That's everything I've got to announce for today. So let's get straight into the show, because I'm really looking forward to this. Obviously, the guest, you've seen him, it's Ron Unz. Ron Unz is a fantastic gentleman, and he does some amazing work exposing Zionist power, the state of Israel, and how the state of Israel controls Western nations such as America. He's got an incredible website, and he's sort of, if he doesn't mind me saying, he's kind of like the Marvel comics of nationalism. He's sort of assembled the Avengers of nationalism. He's got everyone is writing for Ron Unz on the Unz Report. It's fantastic. He's got Jared Taylor. He's got Andrew Anglin. He's had Keith Woods on there. E. Michael Jones. All of the people you can imagine write articles on his site. And it is one of the best read sites on the whole internet that covers a range of issues pertaining to Israel and Zionism. So I'm really looking forward to this show tonight, and it's a real, real honor to have him here with us. I've never written for his site, but I was speaking to him before the show, and I'm going to submit some articles as well, and hopefully if he likes them, he can always publish them. Because it is it would be a real honor to be published there amongst the people who he has writing for him regularly. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to say good evening to him and say, Ron, would you like to introduce yourself? Give us a little bit of background and just basically say hello to the viewers.
Sure. Well, my original background was in theoretical physics. In other words, that was my original academic background. But then about almost 40 years ago, I ended up taking a sort of different turn and leaving graduate school and actually going to work in financial services software. And I was doing that for a number of years. And then after a while, after I moved back to California, I got much more involved in politics and public policy. which were areas I'd always been interested in. In other words, I did a number of initiative campaigns and things like that. And then probably the last 20 years or so, I've mostly been involved in research and writing and publications. And for a while, I was actually the publisher of the American Conservative Magazine. But then about a dozen years ago, I ended up setting up my own website, the UNS Review, which is sort of, I originally viewed it as sort of a venue for my, a possible venue for my own writings. But its orientation is essentially a mixture of those ideas, interesting, controversial, and important ideas that are excluded from the mainstream media. So in other words, we have left-wing writers, right-wing writers, conspiracy writers, racialist writers, libertarians. It's pretty much a range of all those writers and ideas whose views are simply too controversial to be presented or covered by the mainstream media. And, you know, as the years have gone by, the provisions of the mainstream media have tightened more and more, excluding more and more writers. So in other words, you know, the sort of coverage we have has probably in a sense grown as the coverage of the mainstream media is reduced. Now, for the last 7 or 8 years, I've been very heavily involved in my own writing, especially one long series, which is the American Pravda series, focused on really a lot of those historical incidents and episodes in American history over the last 100 or 150 years that I've discovered were very different than what the mainstream media or my college textbooks had reported. In other words, so much of what I'd believed about the history of the Western world over the last century or more was very different than what actually I discovered it to be. And that related a little bit to a project I'd started about 20, 25 years ago, which was the idea of digitizing the archives of many of the most prestigious mainstream publications in American history. You know, for example, the New Republic, The Nation, I mean, the equivalent in Britain of, say, The Spectator, or you know, the major newspapers in Britain. So the whole thing about it is, as I started digitizing these older publications in America, you know, very mainstream elite publications, I gradually discovered that what they said about the events of the time were very, very different than what I ever believed them to be. So in other words, when you're reading headlines in the newspapers or magazines of something from 50 or 80 or 100 years ago that were totally different than what you'd always been told had happened in your college textbooks or in the media, you start to become much more suspicious about other events. And that really was the basis of my American Pravda series, which has now grown to probably close to 1 million words and well over 100 different articles. So, you know, that's pretty much what I've been doing. In other words, investigating and writing many of the major historical events of the last 100 years, and in many cases discovering they're very different than what most Americans probably believe them to be.
Well, indeed, and that's a great jumping off point for something I wanted to talk to you about, because obviously in the news over the last couple of weeks, well, there's been a lot of things relating to Trump in the news, but one of the big things in the news that sort of came over here, because I'm sure things happen in America that don't hop across the pond, but one of the things that hopped across the pond in a big way was the declassification of boxes and boxes of files related to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And for years, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories, or just theories, about the murder of JFK, the assassination of JFK. Now, obviously, there is the official story, and many people have said, well, Lee Harvey Oswald, he went to Russia, he trained in Russia, he had a firearms license in Russia. It was very hard to get a firearms license in Russia. It's not something that you would just get over there. It's not like America where, you know, in the Soviet Union, not like America where every house had a gun. In the Soviet Union, you only had a gun if you were very, very privileged or part of the establishment. And then he came to America. He obviously shot JFK, and then he was conveniently silenced before he went to trial, and everything was nicely wrapped up with a bow on top. And then there's been all these conspiracies. Was it the mafia? Was it actually somehow the Reds? Was it the Soviets? Were they trying you know, to cause World War III or destabilize America. There's been films about this, and many, many people have wrote many different articles, many theories. But something that I wasn't really exposed to until I was exposed to your work was the theory that it was actually, and this has become more and more prominent, it's sort of built on the back of really everything that you've done, and I've heard more and more people talking about this now, is it was actually Israel who played a role in the murder, the assassination of JFK. And this was largely down to JFK's sort of obstinance when it came to assisting Israel with, or turning a blind eye to Israel's development of nuclear weapons. And as such, they wanted somebody in charge in America who would allow sort of the free flow of secrets to Israel and also ensure a blind eye was turned to the development of nuclear arms, which obviously went against nuclear non-proliferation agreements of the time. So please tell us all about this, because I'm actually really fascinated with this. And I've, you know, read quite a number of things pointing in lots of different directions. I do watch a few mafia videos on YouTube, and, you know, the mafia people like to sort of try and claim they had something to do with it, because it's, you know, obviously generates hits. But give us your theories and what you know about this, because it's a fascinating topic.
Sure. Well, what I should say is, until about 12 or 15 years ago, I'd never paid any attention to the JFK assassination. In other words, I firmly believed it was committed by Lee Harvey Oswald, a, you know, deranged lone gunman with nobody else involved. There was no conspiracy. I just never really paid any attention to the issue. And then, you know, as I said, about 12 or 15 years ago, I started getting a little bit suspicious about the issue for the first time and reading a couple of the books that had, you know, come out. I mean, there have been hundreds or even thousands, I think, of JFK assassination books. And as soon as I read a couple of the key books, it became absolutely obvious that he'd been killed, that our president had been killed by a conspiracy, and that what I'd always believed all those years was entirely false. It was, in effect, a cover story. One reason I'd never been suspicious about the JFK assassination was that John F. Kennedy's own brother, Robert Kennedy, was his attorney general, the highest law enforcement officer in the country. And so I always said to myself, you know, even if I, you know, might have become slightly suspicious, I said to myself, well, if there'd been the slightest trace of evidence of any conspiracy, if anybody had believed there was anything there, obviously Robert Kennedy, you know, our top law enforcement officer, would have immediately taken very strong steps to track down the conspiracy, to bring the people who killed his own brother to justice. And yet, you know, again, everything I'd seen was that Robert Kennedy firmly believed there'd been no conspiracy. So, you know, if the president's own brother, the highest law enforcement officer in the country, didn't believe there was a conspiracy, it was very foolish for anybody to believe that. And I never paid any attention to all the conspiracy theories floating around. You know, I was aware of them. I mean, you know, again, there were sometimes mentions in my newspapers of those books and things like that, but I never paid any attention. But as it happened, one of the first books I ended up reading about the JFK assassination was by David Talbot, a highly regarded mainstream author. I think it came out probably about 20, 25 years ago. And he actually focused, he did about 150 interviews of people connected with the Kennedy administration. And it turns out Robert Kennedy, from almost the first moment, believed that his brother had died in a conspiracy. In other words, everything I'd been told about Robert Kennedy's views was entirely wrong. Many other top people in the Kennedy administration also believed that Lee Harvey Oswald had not acted alone. The situation, though, was that Robert Kennedy, the moment he'd been the second most powerful person in the United States after his brother, who was the president, but the moment John F. Kennedy was dead and his bitter enemy Lyndon Johnson, the vice president, became president in his place, all of Robert Kennedy's authority and power disappeared. Robert Kennedy was the superior of J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, but they had a very bad relationship. In other words, Hoover really hated the Kennedys. And so the moment suddenly the president had changed, Hoover refused to take any directives from Robert F. Kennedy. Robert Kennedy lost all of his power, and he told his friends and associates there was nothing he could do to try to investigate his brother's death, except if he then, in some time in the future, reached the White House himself. He was a very young man. He was still in his 30s at the time. Then at that point, he would be able to track down, to break the case open and track down his brother's killer. So, in other words, my entire reason for disbelieving in any conspiracy had been mistaken. It was simply the belief that Robert Kennedy didn't believe in a conspiracy, and that was wrong. So once I then read that book and found out that so many of the key people in the Kennedy administration believed more shots had been fired, believed that a conspiracy had involved, believed that Lee Harvey Oswald had not acted alone, I then started reading quite a number of other books, you know, some of the mainstream JFK assassination books that I'd never paid any attention to. And the evidence of a conspiracy was absolutely overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. Now, again, once you simply come across the, you know, amount of evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald had not acted alone, the question then becomes, who was involved in the conspiracy and why had they assassinated Kennedy? Now, you know, again, there have been so many JFK conspiracy books written over the decades that, you know, every separate possible agent has been, you know, fingered for having been involved. Just as you said, for example, many people felt the mafia was involved, organized crime. Many people believed that elements of the CIA were involved. People pointed to all sorts of different possible culprits and groups that would have been involved. And the truth is, there seems to be a great deal of evidence that certain individuals in the CIA and in organized crime were involved in the conspiracy, but generally at a much lower level in most cases. In other words, you know, there's a difference between the people on the ground who actually, for example, fired the bullets or involved in implementing the assassination, and then the much higher level people who orchestrated the attack. And so when it came down, if you're talking about, for example, the evidence of a conspiracy, one key factor, you know, aside, there's a great deal of evidence, you know, that more gunmen fired and things like that with regard to the JFK assassination. But I think it's important to connect the death of John F. Kennedy with the assassination of his brother, Robert Kennedy, 5 years later. Because as I said, Robert Kennedy had told all of his friends and associates that he planned to run for the presidency himself. And if he ended up reaching the White House and had the reins of power in his hands, he would then be able to break open the conspiracy and avenge the death of his brother. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson became very unpopular because of the disastrous progress of the Vietnam War. So Johnson decided not to run for re-election. He dropped out of the race. At that point, Robert F. Kennedy entered the Democratic primaries as a last-minute contender. He ended up doing extremely well, partly because of his name as the Kennedy and people, you know, regarded him as sort of the heir to his martyred brother. And he ended up then winning a number of crucial primaries and then finally winning the gigantic winner-take-all California primary, putting him on an easy path to the nomination, to the Democratic nomination. And most people felt he would probably be able to win the presidential election coming up in a few months. At the moment he won the Democratic primary in California, as he was, you know, as the victory was being announced, he was suddenly assassinated himself. And so we have two Kennedy assassinations taking place together. And there's quite a lot of evidence that Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated exactly for the reason to prevent him from reaching the White House and avenging his martyred brother. Now, when we're talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that a conspiracy was involved, that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, that more shots were fired. But the evidence is large and complicated. In other words, you have to read articles, you have to read books. It takes quite a lot of effort to come to that conclusion. But in the case of the Robert Kennedy assassination, it's very cut and dried. There's no two ways about it. There's overwhelming physical evidence. For example, the coroner's report in California, the official coroner's report by Thomas DiGucci, showed that Robert F. Kennedy was killed. The fatal shot was fired at point blank range behind him at the back of his head from a distance of probably an inch or 2 inches. The alleged assassin, Sirhan, Sirhan, everybody agrees, was standing 6 or 7 feet in front of him when he fired his bullets. So in other words, there's simply no way he could have been responsible for the fatal injury to Robert F. Kennedy. Furthermore, an audio tape shows that at least a dozen shots were fired, while Sirhan Sirhan's gun only held 8 rounds. And for those reasons, for example, the L.A. coroner declared at the time and in his published memoirs that there obviously had been a second gunman involved. And in fact, eyewitnesses at the time reported that a temporary security guard at the hotel was standing right behind Kennedy at the time he was shot with his gun drawn. It turns out that individual was somebody who had a ferocious, deep personal hatred of the Kennedy brothers. And so I think it's very clear who was involved and who actually fired the fatal shot to kill Kennedy. But all of that was covered up at the trial. In other words, none of this evidence came out at the trial of Sirhan Sirhan. And it was only years or decades later that got enough attention for people to realize what had happened. Now, it turns out, just a couple of years ago, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of the slain presidential candidate, ended up investigating this stuff. All of his life, he believed that Sirhan Sirhan had killed his father, but he was persuaded by one of his father's friends to look at the evidence, to look at the coroner's report, to look at the audio tape, to those things. And it was very clear that Sirhan Sirhan was an innocent patsy. So he ended up actually publishing an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle declaring that Sirhan Sirhan had not been the gunman who killed his father and should be released from prison. If you read some of the books regarding the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, it's very clear that Sirhan Sirhan was essentially a patsy. In other words, he indicated he never remembered having fired the fatal shots. And people at the time described him as seeming to be, you know, almost in a trance, hypnotized under some sort of conditioning. So he was simply used as the distraction, drawing attention to himself as he fired a few wild bullets, while Kennedy was then shot point-blank range from behind by the actual gunman. So, you know, when we have a situation where Robert F. Kennedy has vowed to reach the White House and investigate the killing of his brother and track down the people and bring them to justice, and he's killed right at the moment that his path to the White House became very clear and obvious, I think it shows the direct connection between those two assassinations. So it makes it very likely that the Kennedy brothers were both killed by the same group of individuals or party involved. Now, when we're looking at the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, the fact that the patsy who was selected to draw attention and to take the fall for what happened was a Palestinian immigrant named Sirhan Sirhan, and it was portrayed as being the fact that he killed Kennedy because Kennedy was so pro-Israel. That's what all the media reports said at the time, even though that wasn't really the case. That clearly tends to point in a certain direction. In other words, it would raise obvious suspicions that the Israeli government and pro-Israel groups were responsible for picking a Palestinian patsy who allegedly hated Kennedy for his pro-Israel sentiments, who would take the fall for the assassination. Furthermore, I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but a man named Ronan Bergman, a prominent journalist, several years ago wrote the definitive history of Mossad assassinations. He ended up having full cooperation with the Mossad. His book was endorsed by a number of former Mossad directors. It runs about 700 pages long, and it's a very authoritative account of the Israeli Mossad and its history of assassinations. Obviously, it doesn't include, you know, some of these more, you know, extremely controversial cases of American political figures who've been attacked by Mossad. But it covers an enormous number of Israeli assassinations. And it, in fact, it pretty much clearly indicates that the Israeli Mossad has been responsible for more political assassinations around the world not only than any other intelligence service, such as the CIA or the KGB, but probably more responsible than all these other intelligence services combined. We're talking about probably 2,000 or 3,000 political assassinations over the years. And although they weren't covered in his book, it's certainly established that Israeli Zionist and Mossad groups have been responsible for the attempted assassinations of American presidents and other top political leaders. For example, very few people are aware of it, but Truman, there was an attempt by Zionist forces to assassinate Harry Truman using a letter bomb at the time, at the point when he was hesitating to endorse the establishment of the State of Israel. It's covered, for example, in the memoirs of his own daughter, Margaret Truman, and some of the other people in his administration, but probably it was never covered by the American media at the time. Also, for example, a Mossad defector named Victor Ostrovsky published a couple of bestsellers about 30 years ago, and in them, he revealed that the Mossad had attempted to assassinate President George H.W. Bush at the time when Bush and the Israeli government were at loggerheads over American loan guarantees for West Bank settlements. In other words, they were in a bitter dispute, and the Mossad, the Israeli government, decided to try to arrange Bush's assassination, blaming it on Palestinian terrorist groups. It didn't go ahead, partly because Victor Ostrovsky and some of the other Mossad leaders felt it was far too risky a step, and Ostrovsky basically ended up warning the Bush administration of what was happening. They took the warnings very seriously, and the plot was called off. But when we're talking about, you know, documented, credible attempts to assassinate a couple of other American political presidents and quite a lot of other political leaders around the world. I mean, for example, there are solidly documented attempts that Zionist groups tried to assassinate most of the top leaders of the British government during the period of the time Winston Churchill and the other top cabinet ministers, at the time when Britain was refusing to recognize the independence of the State of Israel. The Zionist groups did assassinate Lord Moyne, the British minister for the Middle East. They assassinated Count Bernadotte, the UN peace negotiator. They've really assassinated more of the sort of very high-ranking political leaders around the world that normally are considered entirely off-limits by any sort of intelligence service that might consider assassinations. So in other words, if we're looking at organizations with a history of political assassinations at a very high level, Zionist groups and the Israeli Mossad would certainly be very high on that list. Now, that all is, in a sense, setting the basis for the Kennedy assassination and examining the nature of the assassination. When we're looking at the Kennedy assassination, one key thing we have to consider is if a conspiracy was involved, the one individual that we're absolutely sure was part of that conspiracy was Jack Ruby, the man who assassinated Lee Harvey Oswald. And when you look at Jack Ruby's background, he basically was somebody involved in organized crime, but he was involved in the Jewish wing of organized crime, which receives much, much less attention than the Italian or Sicilian wing. Furthermore, many of the organized crime figures that Ruby was closest to were individuals very heavily supportive of the State of Israel and very heavily involved in, for example, gun running to the State of Israel during the effort, during the Israeli War of Independence, 1948-1949. So we're talking about an individual who was very close to elements of the Israeli, of the pro-Israel organized crime community groups, like, for example, Meyer Lansky was one of the top figures in American organized crime and a very, very strong supporter of Israel. Furthermore, when Ruby was then arrested and incarcerated, he ended up telling his rabbi who visited him that he shot Lee Harvey Oswald for the Jews. Now, you know, there are a lot of different possible interpretations that have been put on that statement, but that statement was made, and it certainly raises a reasonable suspicion that Ruby was recruited by pro-Israel groups to shut the mouth of Lee Harvey Oswald, who was the patsy that he claimed to be. In other words, under virtually all of the conspiratorial analysis, once you agree that a conspiracy was involved behind the JFK assassination, almost everybody agrees that Lee Harvey Oswald was simply the fall guy, the patsy. He never fired a bullet. He had nothing to do with the event. He was simply the person selected to be blamed for the assassination. And in fact, the other thing about it is, at the time, he was widely portrayed as a communist sympathizer, a Castro sympathizer. All of that was entirely false. There's absolutely overwhelming evidence that he was actually involved with the right-wing anti-Castro groups. In other words, with elements of, for example, the CIA or organized crime that were trying to assassinate Castro or bring him down. And he was simply using the cover of being a pro-communist sympathizer to, you know, discredit Castro, to, for example, pass out leaflets, to do the sort of things that, you know, intelligence services often do to try to discredit their enemies. So the interesting thing about it is when Lee Harvey Oswald defected to Russia, he almost certainly defected as an agent of naval intelligence. In other words, he basically was sent to Russia as part of an intelligence sting operation to pass certain secrets to the Russians that, you know, our intelligence service wanted to get them to find out certain things from them and then to return to the United States. The fact that he was able to freely return to the United States after having allegedly given some of our radar secrets to the Soviet Union is, you know, perfect proof that he was simply, you know, an agent of American intelligence. And then, you know, he continued his activities. In other words, his activities then in conjunction with the efforts to overthrow Castro or possibly see him assassinated were simply part of his continuing intelligence activities. Many people around him, many of the people he worked for and operated with, were part of that same sort of dark area or organized crime and intelligence, lower-level intelligence operatives came together to try to get rid of Castro and achieve other sorts of things. So then we agree that, you know, there's overwhelming evidence there was a conspiracy to kill JFK. And the question is, who did it and why? Now, there were a lot of different organizations that had motives for eliminating Kennedy. For example, organized crime felt that Kennedy had double-crossed them. In other words, they ended up helping him steal enough votes in the 1960 election in Chicago and other and Texas to end up defeating Richard Nixon and win the presidency. And they assumed then he would, in return, call off some of the federal investigations of them. But instead, his brother Robert Kennedy became one of the greatest opponents of organized crime in the United States. So organized crime certainly felt betrayed by Kennedy. But there's no history of organized crime in the United States ever trying to assassinate a political figure remotely as important as the president of the United States. I mean, you know, they might be involved, for example, with a city councilman, with an assemblyman here and there, but there's no record of ever targeting a senator, a governor, anybody of that high level, let alone the president of the United States. So while certain individuals in organized crime might have cooperated in the plot, it's very, very unlikely that they would have been the moving element behind it. Similarly, with regard to the CIA, there's a great deal of evidence, including sworn testimony that later came out, that members of the CIA were involved in the assassination conspiracy, but again, at a relatively low level. In other words, they clearly, you know, for their own reasons, were they and, for example, some of the anti-Castro Cubans that they worked with felt that Kennedy had betrayed them over the Bay of Pigs. And so there certainly were lower level individuals involved in the assassination plot. But there's no evidence that anybody at the top level was involved in organizing the conspiracy. In fact, the interesting thing about it, there's a man named John Newman, who'd spent 20 years in military intelligence working for the Defense Intelligence Agency. Afterwards, he retired and then became a professor of history at the University of Maryland. Over the decades, he's used his skills, intelligence skills he developed over the 20 years of working for the government, to gradually connect and analyze all of the declassified files of the CIA that had been released over the decades. And he came to the conclusion there'd certainly been suspicions attached to individual high-ranking CIA officials that might have been involved in the plot. With Alan Dulles, the former head of the CIA who was fired by Kennedy, usually been the name who most people pointed to as the most likely person to have helped to organize the plot to get rid of Kennedy. But what Newman did by looking at those careful records was to find that they pointed in an entirely different direction. First of all, these intelligence files that had been declassified over the decades provided no indication whatsoever that the CIA as an organization had been involved in the Kennedy conspiracy. In other words, individual CIA officers or members were probably involved, but not the organization as a whole, and certainly not its director. But what he did find is that one particular high-ranking CIA officer, James Angleton, who'd been the longtime head of counterintelligence, was clearly the CIA individual who was involved in the conspiracy. In other words, he helped orchestrate the CIA documents that seemed to point to Lee Harvey Oswald as having been involved and linked to Kremlin assassination plots. And that was the cover story, in effect, that the CIA under Angleton helped produce. The suspicion that Lee Harvey Oswald had killed the President of the United States under the orders of the KGB or the Russian government. And, you know, that was such a horrifying result because it would potentially mean war with Russia, that it was the reason so many individuals were willing to cover up the assassination and say it was a lone gunman, basically a crazy lone gunman, rather than any sort of conspiracy plot. And that was the tremendous insight that Newman produced by spending years analyzing the declassified CIA documents. So one thing I should say, which is a crucial point, and it's now been confirmed by these documents that came out, that were released in the last couple of weeks, Angleton, aside from being the longtime head of counterintelligence, was also the CIA officer closest to the Israeli Mossad and the Israeli government. In fact, he was so close to the Israeli Mossad that at some point suspicions came out that he'd really become a Mossad asset. And after his death, the Israeli government gave him unprecedented honors because of all the help that he'd given them over the years. And in fact, some of the documents that were just released, in fact, some of the highest profile documents released, showed that Angleton had actually helped provide the Israeli governments with nuclear weapons information, assisting their program to develop nuclear weapons, exactly the program that John F. Kennedy had sworn to oppose. Now, the thing is, Angleton's support for the Israeli nuclear weapons program was well known among people who've dug into it. In other words, Seymour Hersh, one of our leading investigative journalists, had published a book 30 years ago revealing that Angleton had assisted the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Many newspapers had reported it, but what these documents revealed was the absolute proof of that fact. In other words, in black and white government documents. Furthermore, it was interesting that many of these documents had previously, parts of them had been suppressed because they discussed the Israeli Mossad's relationship with Angleton. So in other words, it's highly suspicious that the redacted portions of those documents that had previously been released all discussed Angleton's relationship with the Israeli Mossad. So again, that doesn't prove that the Israeli Mossad was responsible, but points very strongly in that direction. Now, the interesting thing about the Israeli Mossad's possible involvement in the JFK assassination is that for the first 30 years after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, every other possible organization or individual was pointed to in the books and articles written by the conspiracy researchers, except for the State of Israel. Nobody had ever raised the slightest suspicion for 30 years that Israel had been involved in the assassination, because it seemed to make absolutely no sense. Nobody believed that there was any motive for an Israeli involvement. John F. Kennedy had won the support of 80% of Jewish voters in the United States when he was elected president. he was viewed in tremendously favorable light by most American Jews. Top American Jews in Hollywood, in Wall Street, in the Ivy League, ended up working in his administration or supporting him very strongly. So he was a tremendous hero for American Jews. And, you know, he was perceived as being very pro-Israel. A couple of the earliest conspiracy researchers who helped break the fact that there was a conspiracy were Mark Lane and Edward Epstein, both of whom came from a Jewish background. And prominent Jewish figures such as Norman Mailer and Mort Saul ended up promoting the notion of a conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy. So in other words, there were so many Jewish individuals, American Jews, involved in all aspects of the JFK administration, supporting him politically, donating money to him. And then after he was assassinated, arguing that he was killed by conspiracy, that the combination of those factors plus no motive for the Israelis to have killed him was one reason that nobody ever suggested that Israel had any involvement. But then in the early 1990s, books started suddenly coming out describing the Israeli nuclear weapons program, nuclear weapons development program, and pointing out that Kennedy had made a huge secret effort to block that program. He'd put enormous pressure on the Israeli government to halt all of its nuclear weapon development program, threatening Israel with a cutoff of all military aid and all support unless they abandoned nuclear weapons development. In fact, his pressure was so severe that Israel's founding premier, David Ben-Gurion, was driven from office. He was forced to resign to avoid, you know, being subject to that pressure from the Kennedy administration. And so suddenly, a motive appeared, a gigantic motive, that possibly explained why Kennedy had been killed and why at least the Israelis could have been involved. And one journalist, Michael Collins Piper, after noticing those books and suddenly putting two and two together, he'd never previously been involved in Kennedy assassination research, ended up starting investigating the issue. And once a motive appeared, all of these previous books had clues that he could easily find that put together showed a tremendous amount of evidence that pro-Israel groups, that individuals closely connected with the Israeli Mossad, and that possible Mossad agents themselves were involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So almost exactly 30 years ago, in late 1994, he published his book called Final Judgment, setting forth for the first time the case that the Israeli Mossad had played a central role in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And that book, such an explosive thesis, it became a bestseller, but an underground bestseller. The idea was so dramatic and so dangerous that absolutely nobody ever discussed it. And that really is a very interesting clue to the whole puzzle. For example, as I started reading JFK assassination books, I noticed that none of them ever mentioned Michael Collin Piper book. For example, you know, these books might have bibliographies of 200 different assassination books, but none of them ever included Piper's book. None of them ever mentioned Piper. None of them even mentioned Piper to denounce his theory as wrong. In other words, his theory was so explosive and so dangerous, especially in the context of the heavily Jewish American publishing industry, that nobody would go near it. And despite that, it still became an underground bestseller with 40,000 copies sold. And once I read it, you know, along with all these other assassination books, being somebody from the outside who'd never paid any attention to, you know, these JFK conspiracies, who never believed they were true, the evidence he provided was so overwhelming that it was clear that he had the strongest case involved. In other words, the thing about the Israeli Mossad and Israel's involvement is Kennedy was up for re-election in another year. He would have a hard time getting re-elected because he'd won election the first time because of his support from the solid Democratic South. But he then came out in favor of black civil rights. So the Southerners had turned very strongly against him. He certainly might have been reelected, but it would have been a very difficult battle. And so most of these groups, for example, the mafia, organized crime, his enemies in the CIA, other groups, Texas billionaires who didn't like him, they could have easily then focused on simply defeating him for re-election. I mean, he would have had a very hard time. I mean, he'd been involved in all sorts of sexual escapades. I mean, there were very, very many women in his background, and that could have been used to damage his position and help get him defeated. One of the very few outside groups that had a motive for killing Kennedy then, rather than trying to defeat him in a year's time, was the Israeli government, because they were under massive Kennedy pressure to halt and eliminate their nuclear weapons program. Besides that, the other clue that came out was that when Kennedy was running for election the first time, a group of extremely wealthy Jewish millionaires, pro-Israel millionaires, had met with him privately and offered to entirely fund his presidential campaign if he would give control of Middle Eastern policy to them, to the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. You know, Kennedy sort of fobbed them off, saying that he certainly supported Israel in many ways. But he was so outraged over that political offer that the next morning he met with one of his closest friends in D.C., a prominent journalist, and told him that if he ended up reaching the White House, he would certainly crack down on the Israel lobby and destroy its power so that something like that could never happen in the future. And he and his brother Robert, the Attorney General, were doing exactly that. They were taking legal steps to declare the Israel lobby a foreign agent, which would have destroyed their power, in effect, to break the power of the Israel lobby. They were at the point of doing so when Kennedy was then assassinated and his brother lost all of his power. And immediately upon Kennedy's assassination, the policy towards the Israel lobby was completely reversed under Lyndon Johnson. And it was allowed to become AIPAC, which now is by far the strongest lobby in the United States and, in effect, controls nearly all the members of Congress. So the Israeli nuclear weapons program and Kennedy's determination to break the domestic power of the Israel lobby were clearly very strong reasons for his assassination. One reason that individuals who've been very skeptical of an Israeli assassin, of a conspiracy against Kennedy, have argued that there would have been no group involved, is when they looked at, for example, the policies of the Kennedy administration and compared them with the policies of his successor, Lyndon Johnson, there was absolute continuity. In other words, Kennedy had started the Vietnam War, Johnson continued it. Kennedy had proposed massive social welfare programs in Congress, Johnson enacted them. Kennedy had proposed civil rights for blacks in the United States, Johnson carried it out. Most of the top officials in the Kennedy administration stayed on and became top officials in the Johnson administration. So people reasonably asked, why would any group have assassinated Kennedy if all they got was exactly the same policies under successor Lyndon Johnson? The one exception, the one and only exception, was our policies towards the state of Israel and the domestic Israel lobby, which immediately underwent a total reversal. So if you're looking for means, motive, and opportunity, all the evidence points very strongly towards Israel and its Mossad as having played a completely central role in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. There's another figure involved as well. You know, I've already mentioned Angleton, you know, somebody very close to Israeli Mossad who helped on the inside of the CIA, setting up the false trail for Oswald as the patsy. But there's one more individual involved. As I started reading these JFK assassination books, one very strange thing I noticed was that almost none of them ever suggested that Lyndon Johnson had been involved. Now, when the president of the United States is assassinated, and his vice president suddenly reaches the Oval Office in his place, I mean, it seemed to me the most obvious person in the world to suspect would be the vice president. I mean, you know, it's, you know, I mean, if a husband and wife are, you know, married and suddenly the husband is killed or the wife is killed, you know, the first thing the police do is say, well, if there's no other suspect, let's, you know, interrogate the other one. And it turns out what I discovered reading these books, Lyndon Johnson was a bitter personal enemy of the Kennedys. They hated each other. Johnson and Kennedy had fought a very bitter battle for the nomination in 1960, and Kennedy defeated Johnson. Johnson had spent most of the 1950s as the most powerful, influential Democrat in America. Kennedy was just a minor senator. Johnson viewed him with contempt, and he certainly never viewed Kennedy as having any chance to win the nomination. But Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, had spent 25 years planning his son's path to the White House. He was one of the wealthiest individuals in the United States and just as ruthless and effective politically as Johnson was. So he ended up spending a huge amount of money, an unprecedented amount of money, on bribery and corruption and payoffs to get his son, John F. Kennedy, the nomination. And so Kennedy ended up defeating Johnson. Kennedy then planned to put one of his friends on the ticket as the vice president. But Johnson then deployed his political assets and probably a considerable amount of blackmail to force himself on the Kennedy ticket as the vice president. So we have a situation where Kennedy and Johnson bitterly hated each other. And in fact, Kennedy then refused to give Johnson any political authority, though he was the vice president. And it turns out Kennedy then planned to get rid of Johnson when running for re-election. In other words, what he was going to do was to kick Johnson off the ticket and then also destroy Johnson, because Johnson himself was a very corrupt individual. A lot of people don't realize Johnson basically was somebody who was born dirt poor. His entire career was spent holding low-paid government jobs. And he entered the White House as one of the richest men in American history, with a personal fortune of, in present-day terms, $100 million. That's because he laundered all of the massive bribes and corruption he took for the political favors he gave through his wife's business. So he was an enormously wealthy, corrupt individual who basically ran Texas. He controlled Texas. And there was actually quite a lot of evidence that he was involved in a number of murders in Texas to protect his corruption schemes. Kennedy knew that. He was aware of that. And so what he was about to do was to use his contacts in the media to destroy Johnson, to basically get the media to write, he was getting Life magazine to write a massive expose of Johnson's history of gigantic corruption back in Texas. At that point, he would then use that expose to drop Johnson from the ticket and probably have Johnson sent to prison. It's shocking, but that gigantic expose of Johnson's corruption that was intended to destroy him and had been orchestrated by the Kennedys was ready to run in the next issue or two of Life magazine. Instead, Kennedy was assassinated before that issue could run. And the same space that had been intended on this massive expose of Johnson's corruption was instead devoted to the Kennedy assassination. So in effect, what happened was Kennedy had been planning to destroy Johnson, drive him for the ticket, send him to prison, and Johnson struck first. Just like the Israelis, Johnson had a very strong motive for not waiting a year for Kennedy's re-election, but striking when he could. And Johnson had all the levers of control once he became president, so he orchestrated the cover-up. He orchestrated, for example, the false autopsy that hid the fact that Kennedy had been struck by several different bullets. He then orchestrated the Warren Commission, the cover-up. He was the president. He had total power over all of these things, and he could block Robert Kennedy from carrying out any investigation himself. It turns out there's actually fairly hard evidence that Johnson was involved in the conspiracy. First of all, Johnson had been the political figure in the United States who was closest to the Israeli government. During the 1950s, Johnson had been the man fighting the Eisenhower administration over its more even-handed Middle Eastern policy. He was certainly viewed as the strongest pro-Zionist, pro-Israel figure in America. So somebody who certainly could have cooperated with the Israelis on their mutual need to eliminate President Kennedy. Also, it turns out Johnson had a man named Mack Wallace was widely viewed as Johnson's sort of personal hitman, who was strongly suspected of having been involved in a number of the killings back in Texas. that Johnson orchestrated. Johnson had tremendous power over the city of Dallas, where Kennedy was assassinated. He controlled the city. And so, you know, he certainly would find it very easy to help organize the details of the conspiracy. It turns out the sniper's nest that allegedly was used by Lee Harvey Oswald to fire the fatal shot, but wasn't. When the police investigated, when the FBI investigated, they found a mysterious fingerprint on one of the boxes that they couldn't identify. Most of the other fingerprints were identified, but not that one. Years later, it was identified as the fingerprint of Mack Wallace, Johnson's personal hitman. Now, it probably wasn't the case that that Mack Wallace fired any of the fatal shots, but he probably was sent to that location to set up the bullets or set up the scene, to basically set up the incriminating evidence implicating Lee Harvey Oswald. Another interesting detail is that Johnson was in the car just behind Kennedy when they moved into the place where the fatal shots were fired. Now, Johnson had been part of the conspiracy, but you know, when you're the vice president of the United States and you know that a sniper is about to assassinate the president of the United States, you're obviously quite a bit nervous, because what if they've decided to shut your mouth by killing you as well? So Johnson, being quite nervous, ended up making all sorts of excuses to duck down in the car as the car approached the fatal scene. And once the first bullet was fired, he reacted more quickly than anybody else. He immediately dropped to the floor of his car. The photographs show all the other individuals remained seated. You know, they'd heard something that sounded like it might be a gunshot. They weren't sure what was going on. They were still visible. Johnson had disappeared because he dropped to the bottom of his car. And eyewitnesses reported the same thing. So in other words, we have a situation where the most pro-Israel political figure in the United States, Lyndon Johnson, who was about to be destroyed by the Kennedy administration and sent to prison, had obviously means, motive, and opportunity to take place in the plot. We have the Israeli government desperate to block Kennedy's efforts to eliminate their nuclear weapons program, and is also his other efforts to destroy the Israel lobby in the United States, also having means, motive, and opportunity, and having the longest track record of involvement in high-level political assassinations of any organization in the world, probably more than CIA, the KGB, and the next 10 intelligence organizations combined. And then we also have James Angleton, the high-ranking CIA official who was the closest to the Israeli Mossad, so close that many suspected him of actually being a Mossad asset, whom the documents proved was the conspirator inside the CIA who set up the false trail implicating Lee Harvey Oswald. So in other words, all of that combined, there certainly were lower level people from organized crime, especially the Jewish wing of organized crime. There were some lower level CIA officers involved in the plot. But the evidence pointing to the central role of the Israeli Mossad and Lyndon Johnson seems extremely strong. And none of these documents released in the last few weeks really, so far at least, seem to really show any new evidence. In other words, they simply confirm the statements and the reports that people have known for 20 or 30 years, but they do confirm them in black and white print. The fact that they were previously released in redacted form in some cases, with the name of the Israeli Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, removed, shows probably that some people at a very high level of the U.S. government or the CIA itself certainly suspected that the Israeli Mossad might have some incriminating evidence in these documents. And it could be that after individuals like John Newman or other experts spend months or years analyzing all the individual documents, the 60,000 pages of documents that have been released, it could be that they will be able to combine them together, connect all the dots, to find out some new discoveries like Newman had done regarding Angleton 30 years ago. But I think the case, the overall case for Lyndon Johnson, the Israeli Mossad, and Angleton's involvement is absolutely extremely strong. And the fact that nobody is willing to discuss it, nobody was willing for 30 years to discuss Piper's book. And even today, almost none of the JFK conspiracy researchers or organizations will ever discuss this idea, shows how tremendously explosive it is, and shows that, you know, they're probably aware of just how dangerous the ground would be if they ended up discussing these subjects. So, I mean, that's basically, you know, what I've put together in reading these books. I've done no new research of my own. I simply read a dozen or 15 of these books after having never paid any attention to the JFK assassination nearly my entire life. And the evidence pointing towards Lyndon Johnson, the Israeli Mossad, and James Angleton as being the key high-level conspirator simply seems overwhelming.
Well, that's fantastic. Sorry, I've just drunk some juice and it's gone down the wrong way. That's incredible. And basically, when you look at it all in the way that you've put it, and you were speaking for sort of almost an hour there, well, maybe 45 minutes because we did a little intro, but that as a self-contained lecture on the issue is so compelling. And throughout, so usually when people are talking for a long time, I sort of interrupt because I see little sort of things that they've either missed or things that I think haven't been explained correctly. And it's only happened to me twice have guests completely explain things. And the list of things I have to ask you on the back of that is basically zero, because you explained everything and all the little things that I thought might be caveats or follow-up questions that I had, you actually answered in your narrative, which makes it even more compelling. Sort of you tied everything up so well. So obviously if the audience has any questions for you on that, we will ask them because we're in the second half of the show. If you haven't donated yet and you want to donate, if you haven't contributed to the stream and you'd like to, it would be very much appreciated. We haven't got as many donations and questions tonight as we usually get, which is a bit of a shame. So please do consider making a donation if you can. Obviously, you know, this is how I keep my head above water. So if you guys would like me to keep doing shows like this, please do consider donating. But I do have one question for Ron before we move forward. And it's incredible what he's done here as well. Sort of, it's almost like he's followed every little scrap of evidence that other people have presented and sort of put it all together in a way that I was completely spellbound. And usually when people are talking like this, I do a lot of Googling. So my eyes are all over the place because all the things he was mentioning, I was sort of Googling and checking, and everything he said here is so well researched. I couldn't found anything when he was talking that I found to be a flaw in that. And his explanation of sort of why Lee Harvey Oswald was in Russia, etc., makes perfect sense, especially, you know, I dropped that in at the beginning, and that was the one sort of big smoking gun that people have when they claim it was a Soviet plot, was why was he in Russia? And Ron's explained that very, very succinctly. So my question now for you, and really, I'm sort of sorry that I couldn't book you in for sort of 4 hours because I could listen to a lot more of this, but we've only got 2 hours. But just quickly before we do go for the questions for what we've got from the audience, and I can always shoot some over if there aren't any more coming in. But the question I've got for you now is, when Trump came to power, I said on a couple of shows, one of two things is about to happen. You're either going to get Trump coming in and he will be more amenable to stopping what's going on in the Ukraine, but more likely to escalate what's going on in the Middle East. And I said, if a Democrat comes in, if Harris gets in, that's more likely to be a power base that would call for restraint in the Middle East and not necessarily want to get us involved in the Middle East, but it would be less restrained in Eastern Europe and more anti-Russian than Trump will be. So we've sort of tossed that coin. Overwhelmingly, it came up Trump. I mean, he won everything, and he won everything so emphatically, it's left the Democrats sort of squabbling amongst themselves, trying to figure out where they want to go next to combat this. But it's also left Trump with the power to essentially take America into a war with a sizable backing. And before he came to power, and I have to credit the people who said this, and it was Warren Baylog who really pushed this point home, that if Trump did come to power, he would be the one man that could re-energize young white American men to go sign up and fight for America in the war, in a war in the Middle East. And obviously, over the last few days, we've seen this rapid escalation of sort of calls for an invasion of Iran, Trump talking about invading Iran, and the sort of right-wing press around the world talking about Iran's ability to strike US and UK bases in places like the Chagos Islands, saying that, you know, Iran's now this big threat, they're considering attacking bases, and we should have a preemptive strike. And you can always tell when there's going to be something like this kicking off, because the Daily Mail, who are very, very good at locking down their comments section, so there's no racism, there's no sort of bigotry, there's no calls for violence, all of those blocks come off when they want a war to come about. So you can't talk badly about Muslim men who rape young white girls in Britain, because you'll get banned in the comment section. But if you talk about how great it would be to string up Russian soldiers by their feet and torture them to death, your comment's fine. And I've noticed in the last couple of days, comments about how Iran should be sort of bombed until it's glass, or, you know, every last building in Iran should be leveled. You know, men, women and children should be slaughtered en masse. And it was about time we did this. They're all being let through and voted up almost as if they were being botted, as if they were bot comments. What do you think the likelihood is of Trump going into Iran? And if he was to go into Iran, do you think he would take this beyond just a bombing campaign? Because obviously it's one thing destabilizing a nation with missiles and bombs. It's another thing taking it to boots on the ground, which would inevitably lead, however you looked at it, to the loss of American lives.
Well, I mean, I certainly Trump has been making a lot of noises the last few days about going to war with Iran. You know, it's unclear to me whether that's more of a bluff or whether he's actually planning to do that. Because, I mean, I'm not a military expert, but most of the military experts whose opinion I take very highly are geopolitical experts, agree it would be a gigantic disaster for the world and for the United States if we did start a war with Iran. Obviously, it makes no sense geopolitically, since Iran has certainly been willing to negotiate. In other words, we'd already signed a nuclear agreement with Iran under the Obama administration. Obviously, Israel is driving America's policy, driving the Trump administration, and has been making efforts. Netanyahu has been making efforts for probably 30 years to get America to 20 or 30 years to get America to attack Iran. So, you know, with Israel now riding so high within the Trump administration, they feel this is the opportunity to strike and do something like that. And they're certainly doing everything they can to sort of manipulate Trump into taking that action and manipulate the elite, some of the top figures, some of the top Trump advisors to do that. But, I mean, at least the military experts I know believe it would be such a gigantic disaster for the United States and for the world. I mean, basically, Iran would fire its missiles to destroy our bases. I mean, they have hypersonic missiles. They could probably sink an aircraft carrier or two. I mean, we're talking about possibly tens of thousands of Americans being killed by Iranian missiles if we attack them. Furthermore, I think the likelihood of our being able to put boots on the ground in Iran is very, very low. In other words, we'd be talking about having to put together hundreds of thousands of invasion troops. Iran is a country so much larger, it's three times the size of Iraq, and we had a disaster in trying to occupy Iraq. I think there's almost no chance something like that would be successful. And also, you remember, at this point in time, the Russians have very bad relations with the United States, because basically we've been fighting a proxy war in Ukraine on Russia's own border. We've been killing Russians with our intelligence information, with the missiles we provide. So the Russians would certainly support the Iranians. The Chinese would as well. And I mean, it would be a total disaster. And I mean, oil prices would probably go to hundreds of dollars a barrel. I mean, gasoline in the United States would go to $10 a gallon or something like that. It would cause a worldwide economic disaster. I mean, for example, the Iranians probably would fire their missiles to destroy the oil facilities of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, because if their facilities were being destroyed, why should they allow those of American allies to survive? So, I mean, the result would be a gigantic total disaster. But, I mean, Trump is such an ignorant individual and so gullible and so easily manipulated. Just because something is a total disaster doesn't necessarily mean that Trump won't do it. Now, most of the analysts I've been following think that the evidence of it being such a gigantic disaster for the United States, really bringing down the Trump administration, bringing down the Western world. I mean, putting the entire globe in a global, you know, depression is so bad that Trump is simply bluffing. In other words, Trump is somebody who bluffs a lot. So in other words, talking about bombing Iran may simply be a move he's making to negotiate the best possible deal he will be with Iran. For example, he did the same thing with North Korea. He made all sorts of threats to bomb North Korea in his first administration and then tried to work out a deal with North Korea. So I'm certainly hoping we don't go to war with Iran. But I mean, if we do, I think it would very likely be the end of American power. You know, if you call America an empire, it would mark the fall of the American empire. And I mean, a disaster of unmitigated proportions, probably the worst thing that had ever happened in America's nearly 250-year history. So I hope he doesn't do it.
Well, I think the thing with Trump is I've always described Trump as kind of like the wild card. You never know what you're going to get. It's kind of like he's that sort of friend where you go on a night out with him. And it can either be the best night out or the worst night out. And at any time during the night, it can flip from one to the other and potentially back again. He just throws out those curveballs. And sometimes he leaves you laughing. Sometimes he leaves you cheering. But he also can leave you sort of, you know, beating your fist against a wall in pure rage at his stupidity and seemingly, you know, mad sort of about turns. I mean, as we've been talking, so the news has been breaking that he's been telling his insiders that he's getting rid of Elon Musk, which...
My God, that's a big step.
I mean, well, apparently this has caused the Tesla stock to go up. So Googling it now, Musk... Elon Musk, he's actually done it. Elon Musk dramatically steps down from his DOGE in shock move after Trump expressed private doubts. So President Trump has reportedly informed his cabinet and inner circle that Elon Musk will be stepping back from his high-profile government role in the coming weeks. He'll be returning to the business world. So apparently that is it. Musk is done. And he is leaving. So the Daily Mail have said that he is definitely stepping down. And this has caused the Tesla stock to rise somewhat. But that is one thing I certainly didn't see coming. But it is kind of like one of those things with Trump where he does tend to sort of run a very unstable ship, and people who are sort of first mate one day can be getting keel hauled the next day. And it's kind of it's very strange how that happens. I kind of see it as like in most sort of establishments, you work your way up and, you know, this takes time. And then you can get demoted, and obviously you can get sacked and go right down the ladder. But with Trump, it's kind of a little bit more wild. That it's kind of like Nero's court, where one minute you can be the guy sort of, you know, serving the glasses of water to people in a meeting. The next day, Trump's taken a liking to you and you can basically be defense secretary. And 2 days later, you're sacked, humiliated, and you'll never work in politics again. And it's kind of like the 3-day rise and fall of the water boy. I don't know what you think about this and whether you think Musk going will be a big gain or a big loss to Trump?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, again, there have been a lot of controversies regarding Musk's Doge project. And, you know, a lot of people think it could be causing like a disaster with checks, Social Security checks not going out or things like that. But I mean, Musk is certainly, you know, one of those powerful people in the administration, even though he didn't have an official title. So I certainly didn't expect this sort of thing to happen. In fact, given that leaked conversation regarding the bombing of Yemen, you know, that was leaked to that Atlantic reporter. I mean, there was a lot of speculation that the guy who set up the conversation on that open channel and was responsible for bringing in Goldberg, you know, the Atlantic reporter, Michael Waltz, you know, Trump's national security advisor, would be fired. So, you know, if the word had come out that Waltz had been fired, I wouldn't really be that surprised. But I didn't see Musk's removal. on the horizon.
No, it is very odd. Anyway, we'll go to questions from the audience. And if you haven't super chatted yet and you want to, please consider doing so. Open Borders for Israel gave $5. Thank you so much. I love Ron Unz's site and his excellent articles. Is the ADL still quiet about Ron, or are they coming after him now?
Oh, very much so. In other words, that's actually an interesting story. Until about 6 or 7 years ago, when I started writing, some of my more controversial articles, I was sort of reasonably well known for, sometimes writing things that were sort of a little bit edgy or a little bit controversial, but nothing like, any of this stuff. And then about 6 years ago, I really started my American Pravda series in earnest and ended up going through, for example, Kennedy assassination issue, 9/11, World War II, all of these ultra, ultra controversial issues. And a lot of people at the time start saying, my God, why isn't the ADL attacking you? The ADL attacks people who do even a tiny sliver of the sort of writing that I'd done. And I sort of said, well, I think probably they're just nervous about bringing attention to me. And that's the reason they're not attacking to me. So I ended up actually publishing a couple of pieces, laughing at the ADL for being too scared to take me on or something like that. And they finally published a very mealy-mouthed, anonymous post, just sort of mildly criticizing me a little bit. I mean, something very, very minor. And that gave me the opening to then reveal the true history of the ADL, which I knew quite well about and which most people did not. And, for example, the ADL was founded just over 100 years ago with the primary mission of preventing the just punishment of a Jewish rapist and murderer. In other words, a guy named, Leo Frank, had basically raped and murdered a young girl, a 13-year-old girl. He was obviously guilty. He was sentenced to death. The ADL was organized and raised a gigantic amount of money to prevent him from being punished. He was, for its entire history, presented as like the great hero, the founding hero of the ADL, the martyred Jewish victim. But anybody really looks into the case in any detail, contrary to just taking what, our textbooks say, there's absolutely overwhelming evidence that Leo Frank was entirely guilty. Not only that, but Leo Frank was in the South. And to try to avoid being punished for his crime, he tried to orchestrate the lynchings of several innocent black men. So we're talking about basically a Jewish child molester and killer who raped and murdered a 13-year-old girl, and then to basically save his own neck, tried to orchestrate the lynchings of innocent black men. I mean, you can't imagine anything that would sound worse in American history, but it's all been covered up by the American media and American textbooks for 100 years. Also, for example, the ADL was probably heavily involved in bugging Martin Luther King's hotel room. In other words, people have always condemned the FBI for having bugged Martin Luther King and had those secret tapes of Martin Luther King's activities with prostitutes and women. It was actually the ADL with this. The ADL, for example, had files 25 years ago, they already had files on over 1 million Americans. It had really become the equivalent of an American Stasi organization. So anyway, the ADL published a short, anonymous, rather milquetoast piece criticizing me in mild terms. I then responded with a long article providing the documented true history of the ADL. And the ADL since then has kept a very wide berth of my website. And it's basically avoided even mentioning my name. Not only that, but they've apparently issued some sort of, it seems very likely they've issued some sort of edict or demand that no mainstream media organization ever be willing to mention the existence of our website or mention my name in particular, for risk of the fact of gaining attention. So, for example, in some cases, there have been major scandals dominating the American media, that I've actually read about in the New York Times. And I've said, oh, interesting scandal. What really is going on there? And I've discovered those scandals involve an article written and published on our own website. But the media coverage was so carefully written that I didn't even realize they were talking about our own website. So, again, the ADL, certainly, it would be very nice if the ADL were willing to take me on. in any sort of way to attack me in the strongest way they could. But unfortunately, I've had no success in luring them into taking that sort of action.
Well, thank you. Milos M gave $1.40. Thank you so much. An endless bow to Mark for bringing Ron Uns to the stream. Sadly, I'll have to miss it, but kudos nonetheless. At least one of my PWR wishes has come true. I now hope for Russell Brand. Well, that one is not happening, I don't think. Maybe better next time, sent $3. Thank you so much. And he said, thank you for your work. Well, thank you very much. Jez9999 gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, Ron, do you buy the official story on the Trump shooting that a gunman grazed his ear and the Secret Service were too incompetent to prevent it?
Well, I can't be entirely sure, but yes, I generally believe that story occurred for one simple reason. And, you know, again, that was my first reaction at the time. If there had actually been, there are a number of different conspiracy theories out there, but I mean, one of them obviously is that there was a deliberate attack, an organized conspiratorial attack to kill Donald Trump. And he certainly had enough enemies and enough groups that wanted to kill him. The main reason I don't think that's the case is Donald Trump wasn't killed. In other words, if you were going after Donald Trump, you would have brought in a very professional hitman. Or several of them, several professional snipers. So, for example, the guy who was shot and killed would have been a perfectly useful distractor. In other words, a patsy, somebody put out there to attract people's attention while your professional sniper kills Trump. But I mean, that's what they would have done. I mean, the guy who actually they ended up shooting and killing was just some sort of random guy. He wasn't particularly a good shot. And if you're organizing a conspiracy to kill Donald Trump, you bring in a very top quality sniper. Another conspiracy theory out there is basically that it was orchestrated by Trump's supporters or by Donald Trump to get sympathy for him. And I'm very skeptical of that. In other words, if you're Donald Trump and somebody comes to you and says, we have a great idea to help you get elected, we're going to bring in a sniper. He's going to shoot at your head, miss your ear by, you know, a fraction of an inch. And so don't worry, you know, don't worry if there's a sniper shooting at your head. Everything's going to be fine. He's one of our people. I just find it very doubtful that even somebody as gullible as Donald Trump would have supported something like that. So as far as I can say, I'm not saying the official story sounds all that plausible, but I'm saying that stories, the conspiratorial cases, either by a pro-Trump side or an anti-Trump side, conspiracy seem even less plausible given what had happened. To put it another way, if Donald Trump had been shot and killed, I would have been almost sure it was done as part of a conspiracy. You know, just the way in the JFK assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, you bring in some, you know, distractor, some patsy to fire a few bullets in the right direction. And then you have a top quality sniper firing from much longer range that kills the candidate. So the fact that Donald Trump survived, I think, is the main reason I think it probably was, you know, just that random guy who shot at him. Now, one interesting thing about that case is what I was really surprised at was not that somebody tried to shoot Donald Trump, but that it hadn't already happened 20 or 30 previous times. I mean, remember, the mainstream media in the United States had spent 8 years portraying Donald Trump as the most evil, dangerous man in the United States. Somebody who was a horrible enemy of American freedom, who was the greatest enemy of American society that had come about in decades. So you would think that would be exactly the sort of thing that would encourage a few individual people with a few screws loose to go and try to shoot Donald Trump. In other words, you know, I've been expecting somebody to take shots at Donald Trump for years when he was president and then when he then tried to run for re-election. And I was just very surprised. Nothing had happened until right at the end. So, you know, it's possible, for example, that the Secret Service then was ordered to relax their guard to some extent and make it easier, for example, for somebody to get to Donald Trump. But I mean, that's the most I probably would, you know, believe that any sort of conspiracy was involved.
Yeah, I'm sort of inclined to sort of, you know, agree with what you're saying here. I mean, at the end of the day, if Trump had been shot dead and then there was some dysfunctional sort of drug addled, you know, or prescription drugs, young lad who'd been on the internet and had conveniently just written a manifesto. You know, he could barely shoot a rifle, but somebody over his shoulder had been, you know, taking Trump's, you know, eye out from 1,000 meters. That's kind of more what you're expecting. I will say this. People put forward a number of serious arguments saying, look, he was in a very obvious space. He was on the roof, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the Secret Service didn't seem to do about anything about it. Lots of people shouted gunman and it took them ages to actually do anything. I think some of that is literally incompetence. You know, I know here in the UK, when I was a young lad, all police officers were big men who were, you know, they had to be over 6 foot tall. They were impressively built. They were the sort of people who'd be rugby players or sportsmen. They'd go into the, you know, the forces, and they were a force to be reckoned with. Now you see these little women who are barely 5 foot. They're as wide as they are tall. And you think to yourself, well, are they really going to stop a group of young lads who are shoplifting or stop people fighting in the street? The answer is no, of course they're not. But they're there because the state demands that certain number of these, you know, positions are filled by women who look like that. And I think a lot of the sort of decline in the effectiveness of security services, the police, etc., is down to these diversity targets, really. And, you know, there's also, you know, When you're arranging something like that, I'm sure, you know, you're doing security on a level like that. I'm sure as well, getting all the different groups, sort of, you know, state police and federal agencies to coordinate is probably a nightmare as well. So, you know, and obviously Trump was quite lucky they didn't kill him. And it probably was one of the things that propelled him to power. So I should think if you asked Donald Trump, you know, would he have rather been shot in the ear or not? He'd probably tell you, yes, I'd have rather been shot in the ear. Because, you know, in American history, there are certain moments where iconic images are sort of taken. And that picture of Trump, you know, forcing his way up through the Secret Service thing, putting his fist in the air with blood coming from his ear, will go down in history, you know. And everyone wants, you know, every politician wants to be in a situation like that where they emerge victorious. So for him, it was probably a good thing. The resident baker gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, evening, Mark. Very interesting guest on the subject of Trump and his relationship with Israel and the Jewish lobby. Does Ron believe it is likely that Trump is being blackmailed, or is he purely a coin operated and transactional person?
There certainly might be blackmail involved. In other words, you know, the Israel lobby has made efforts, I mean, with the Jeffrey Epstein ring and other things like that, for decades to gain blackmail holds over as many powerful American political figures as possible. And, I mean, Trump certainly might be under pressure that way. But, you know, it's also possible. I mean, what the Israel lobby has successfully done is ensure that almost all of the political leaders and advisors in the Republican Party and in the Trump administration are aligned with their interests. Furthermore, the media obviously is totally under control of the Israel lobby, you know, both the right-wing media and the left-wing media and the mainstream media. I mean, whether it's New York Times or Fox News. So, you know, if you're someone like Donald Trump who doesn't really have a good knowledge of the world and all of your advisors are lined up on a certain position, and when you watch Fox News, or, you know, even if you take a look at some of the more mainstream things, maybe in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, that also seems to be lined up in the same position. If all the people talking to you are telling you the same thing about a subject about which you don't have a great deal of personal expertise and knowledge, I mean, that by itself might be enough to get you to take steps that Israel wants, but that would be an utter disaster for the United States. I mean, for example, it's quite possible that Trump has been told by CIA officials that, you know, Iran's air defenses were severely damaged by the Israeli attack before, that the Iranian missiles don't work, that it would be a cakewalk for America to attack Iran and, you know, devastate the country. So, you know, again, if all of these experts in the CIA and Trump's advisors tell him that, I mean, he might believe it. I mean, for example, take Trump's defense secretary, Hegseth. I mean, basically, he doesn't know anything about this stuff. He was basically just a pundit on Fox TV. I mean, you know, again, you're talking about just some random pundit on Fox TV who was suddenly made Defense Secretary of the United States. So, I mean, where does he get his information? You know, and I mean, it's sort of, he probably gets it from, like, people who are in the pay of the Israel lobby.
I was just Googling another one, because one that really amused me was a guy called Dan Bongino.
Oh, exactly. Bongino, right.
Yeah, like, I've got nothing against Dan Bongino, but I always see his streams pop up on Rumble. And it's like, oh, who's Dan Bongino? He's doing a stream on Rumble. He gets really big numbers. He seems quite popular. And the next minute, he's like head of the FBI or something.
Exactly. It's insane. I mean, it's just totally, you know, when we're talking about it, it's sort of like just, I mean, it, you know, it's sort of like basically if Trump had watched your podcast and said, how would you like to be head of the FBI?
Yeah.
I
mean, but it's what you'd expect in kind of like, you know, when you see these sort of badly run South American sort of oil-rich sort of dictatorships, there's someone who fixed the great leader's car and did him a good deal when he was 16, which helped him pull the girl that's now his wife. He's like, I never forgot you fixed the tires on my car. You're now in charge of farming. And the guy's like, I'm not about farming. He's like, well, it's a well-paid job. And it kind of felt with Dan Bon, and this is nothing against Dan Bongino, but I was kind of like, who is he? Why is he getting these big views over on Rumble? They're really pushing him. And the next minute, he's like second in command of the FBI. And it's like, he obviously said all the right things about Trump when Trump happened to be watching Rumble one day. And that, you know, I should have written a really nice book about Trump just in the sort of, you know, like, it'd be like buying a lottery ticket. You're probably not going to win. But, you know, on the off chance that he picks your book up and likes it, you've got a job, you know, until like, you know, it's like being in Nero's constantly sours of you and then it's off in your head. You know? it's very entertaining. Thin Red Line gave $10. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, Mr. Unz, most of the Jewish billionaires have supported Trump in the last election. Do you think they'll return to supporting the Democrats in the next election? Or do you think it's a permanent shift to the right amongst the billionaire class?
Well, I mean, the billionaires, including almost all of the Jewish billionaires, have been totally opposed to Trump during his first term when he ran in 2016 and when he ran for re-election 2020. I think the key factor that shifted them around was the Hamas attack on Israel, because it basically focused all of the Jewish billionaires, or a very large number of them, on the Israel issue as being absolutely central and most important. And since Trump was even more pro-Israel than the Biden administration, which itself was very pro-Israel, many of them gravitated towards Trump in hopes that Trump then would destroy all of Israel's enemies, would attack Iran. For example, Benjamin Netanyahu shifted his support gradually towards Trump in hopes that Trump would be even more supportive of his policies than the Biden administration had been. And I mean, Biden was incredibly supportive. I mean, Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, I mean, but basically, Blinken, when he was a young man, gave his extra bedroom to Benjamin Netanyahu when he was visiting the United States. So he has a long history of being very, very close to the hardline Israeli government and Israel's prime minister. But compared to the Democratic Party, which had, again, some lower-level Democrats who were much more opposed to what was going on in the Middle East, Trump was even more pro-Israel. So, you know, that shifted more of the Jewish billionaires and also Jewish activists towards Trump. The other factor also had been all of these demonstrations against Israel on college campuses, because the Biden administration, even though it helped crack down on them, was not willing to take the strong steps to suppress freedom of speech on American university campuses as the Trump administration has been. So for all those reasons, I think without the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th, you know, I think it would have been very unlikely that all of these Jewish billionaires would have shifted over to Trump now. They probably would have still opposed him like they did the first time. I mean, he might have won anyway, but it probably would have been much more difficult.
Well, thank you. Y gave $10. Thanks so much. Said, Ron, given the involvement of Israel and Jews in many of these pivotal conspiracies that have dramatically changed Western civilization, do you have any thoughts on whether anti-Semitism is a justifiable reaction?
Well, again, it depends what you mean by anti-Semitism. In other words, nowadays, you know, the term anti-Semitism obviously means, you know, dislike or criticizing Jews or disliking Jews or that sort of thing. And obviously it can be taken to the extent of, you know, having views like that that are, you know, extremely strong or unreasonably strong. Nowadays, a lot of Israel supporters have argued that anti-Zionism actually is a form of anti-Semitism. So in other words, they have said that anti-Semitism is sort of the broader category, but anti-Zionism is part of that. And anti-Zionism similarly means disliking the state of Israel or criticizing the state of Israel. Now, I mean, the problem is, you know, over the last year and a half since the Hamas attack, the state of Israel has committed a gigantic massacre of innocent men, women, and children in Gaza. I mean, basically, they've killed at least tens of thousands, possibly more like hundreds of thousands. I mean, the International Court of Justice, in a series of near unanimous rulings, many of them endorsed by the former Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, have declared that Israel is plausibly being accused of committing genocide. Now, most Westerners these days, you know, have a negative view of genocide. They regard genocide as not being a good thing. And so when the Israeli government has been accused of all these international, highly regarded jurists of engaging in genocide against the innocent civilians of the West Bank of Gaza, then I think criticizing the Israeli government or opposing the Israeli government seems a fairly reasonable position to take. But that constitutes anti-Zionism. And anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. So it comes down to, if the pro-Israel lobby is right and anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, then either you support genocide or you have to be anti-Semitic. And, it, you know, it's a very difficult Hobson's choice people are facing, which is why most people keep silent as much as possible and avoid the issue.
That's a very, very good way of putting it. This is that is excellent. So thank you very much. $14 came from Thin Red Line. Thank you so much. Said, Mr. Unz, how large a percentage of the Jews in America do you think support Israel's war in Gaza?
That's a good question. I mean, the polls I've seen, they vary. And it varies also the time period you're talking about or when you ask the question. For example, initially, in the first few weeks after the attack, I think support among American Jews was probably in the 70 or 80% range. In other words, you know, there was sort of all of the wagons were being circled. And also, for example, there was all this massively dishonest propaganda accusing Hamas, for example, of beheading babies. There were all those news stories about the 40 beheaded babies, babies baked in ovens, mass gang rapes, and all of it turned out to be total nonsense. In fact, the Israeli government itself refused to sort of endorse those stories. I mean, they were so ridiculous. It was all just dishonest propaganda. So, you know, as some of those facts started to gradually come out, and as more and more reports came out about the gigantic number of civilians being killed in Gaza, you know, men, women, and children, little babies being blown apart, and it circumvented the gatekeepers of the mainstream media. In other words, if all one knew of what was going on in the Israeli attacks on Gaza came from the newspapers, came from network television, came from cable TV, very few people would be aware of these things. But because of social media, because of YouTube, because of Elon Musk's Twitter, because of TikTok, people are seeing these horrific scenes of so many dead civilians caused by the Israeli bombardment. And these stories come out, these horrible Israeli atrocities, many of which are proudly broadcast by Israeli soldiers. They're the ones putting it on Twitter because they're so proud of the atrocities they're committing. So based on that, the figures I've seen are that I think probably it's reached the point where close to a majority of younger American Jews, the ones who get their information from TikTok and Twitter and YouTube, are now being much more critical of Israel and probably no longer supporting the attack. I think still probably a majority of the older, middle-aged American Jews who get their information from, you know, CBS News and the New York Times might still be supporting it. So, you know, the numbers have certainly sharply gone down over time, over the last year and a half. And so it might be now that it's a minority who still support the Israeli policy, but it's certainly, you know, a very sizable number still do.
Thank you. It Was Made Up gave $10. Thank you so much. Said, how does Ron think things will work out in the UK with regards to the uni party, free speech, two-tier policing, and the political trap we seem to be in? Does he think there will be some sort of collapse, or will the anti-white regime just trundle on?
I think at some point, I mean, there really might be a collapse of the political system in so many of these West European countries. In other words, you know, the British economy is in terrible shape right now. Britain has so many problems. Starmer, for example, won a gigantic landslide because the Conservatives were so unpopular. But the policies he's implemented have been so unpopular, at least last time I saw any numbers reported, his numbers were, I think, the lowest of almost any British prime minister. So in other words, when both of the major parties, the traditional major parties in Britain, are so incredibly unpopular, it provides an opening for something like the Reform Party to come in. And it's not clear to me whether the Reform Party would be so much different than these two major parties. But at least they're different than those two major parties, and maybe they would, you know, improve some of these things. I mean, the problem is the political system in all of these major West European countries and in the United States have largely been captured by so many of these powerful lobbies. Certainly the Israel lobby, but also the military contractor lobby, the Wall Street lobby, so many of these different lobbies, that almost none of the politicians have any independence. In other words, you know, it's interesting. Obama, for example, when he was elected president, was regarded as the absolute anti-George Bush. He would totally overturn all of George Bush's policies. The reason people voted for an almost unknown black guy named Barack Hussein Obama was because Bush's policies were so unpopular. But once Obama came in, he continued all of Bush's policies. For example, he kept Bush's defense secretary. He took one of Bush's top treasury officials and promoted him to run the treasury. He kept Bush's chairman of the Federal Reserve. So, you know, Obama's administration became almost Bush's third term. And in the same way, for example, the Biden administration was regarded as a total repudiation of Trump's policies, but they've continued many of Trump's policies. The problem is so many of the political figures in all the parties, not only in Western Europe, but in the United States, have been co-opted and in a sense bribed or intimidated or blackmailed that they have almost no independence. I mean, take, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, he has an arrest warrant out for him as an accused war criminal. I mean, he's been accused of committing genocide by the International Court of Justice. He's incredibly unpopular. He was incredibly unpopular in his own government of Israel. He's accused of all sorts of corruption, and he was basically barely staying out of prison in Israel. When he visited the United States, he was given an unprecedented fifth chance to address a joint session of both houses of Congress. And almost all the members of Congress gave him, I think it was something like 35 standing ovations, more than anybody had ever received, clapping endlessly for this accused war criminal with an international arrest warrant out for him. And that's because virtually every member of Congress is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby. In fact, a Thomas Massie, one of the very, very few honest members of Congress, was on Tucker Carlson some months ago and explained that every member of Congress has an Israel minder, who basically looks after him and tells him how to vote on all these issues. I mean, it's really just bizarre when, you know, every elected official in the United States has all these people behind them. Not only that, but when any of them deviate from, you know, these policies, for example, a couple of the most radical black members of the Black Caucus, who'd won, you know, in heavily black districts with overwhelming support, they ended up actually coming out and supporting a ceasefire in Gaza at one point in a very mild sort of way. The Israel lobby dumped $8 million and $16 million to drive them from office, to have them defeated in their own primaries, more than anybody ever spent on a congressional primary. Both of them were defeated. So, I mean, the truth is, in the United States today, elected officials know that if they are viewed as insufficiently loyal to a foreign country and a foreign government, they'll be quickly removed from office. And I mean, that's not the sort of thing you find in political history textbooks, political science textbooks, that our government is run by people who know that unless they're sufficiently loyal to a foreign country, they'll immediately be removed from their position. And that's why the country's in the terrible mess it's in. And that's why there's certainly at least a reasonable chance that Donald Trump will start a war with Iran that will be an utter disaster for both America and the world. I mean, we'll destroy the Middle East and destroy the global economy.
Thank you very much. Jagdeep Jaina gave $15. Thank you so much. Said, hey, both, could I get your thoughts on Pizzagate, Comet Ping Pong, James Alafantis, the Podesta brothers, and the 2016 WikiLeaks publishing of Democrat emails? Many believe it points to a network of abuse with ties to the occult. If so, how significant is this?
Yeah, I've actually written some articles on it. I mean, at the time the Pizzagate thing came up, I guess it was about 5 or 6 years ago. You know, by now it must be closer to 8 years ago. I really didn't pay any attention to that. But then when I saw a few of those stories floating around, some of the issues were so bizarre and the media coverage was so outrageous. In other words, it was sort of like flashing a bright neon sign saying, nothing to see here. The first cancellations that had ever taken place on YouTube, the first time people were ever dropped from YouTube, not for saying something that was unpermitted, but simply for saying controversial things, was at the time of the Pizzagate controversy. So I've actually written some articles saying that I think there's a very high likelihood the Pizzagate story basically was true. And, you know, I've discussed, I've analyzed in some of my articles. And what it points to is, again, blackmail is one of the key tools for controlling elected political officials. It has been for many, many decades, not only with the Israel lobby, but most strongly with the Israel lobby, with Jeffrey Epstein and everything like that. So, I mean, we're talking nowadays, for example, traditionally people were blackmailed if they were, for example, if it was discovered, say, that they were gay, that they were homosexual. You know, like J. Edgar Hoover apparently had photographs showing him, you know, in homosexual activity. And that was why organized crime was able to prevent him from ever, you know, trying to uproot organized crime in the United States. The problem blackmailers face right now is that so many of these things have now been legalized and are considered proper activity. I mean, if the head of the FBI now were found to be, you know, gay, were found to be homosexual, he would be proudly proclaiming it as being something that would strengthen his political position. So that means blackmailers have to turn to tools that are still considered so horrific they can be held over the heads of politicians. And certainly, you know, being involved with underage children, as Pizzagate allegedly was, I mean, being basically a child molester, a pedophile, is exactly that sort of weapon. So in other words, it's exactly the sort of tool that would be used nowadays in American society to control powerful politicians who can't be controlled in any other way. In other words, when you're talking about a political leader right now, many of them, you know, have used insider trading and other things like that to become very wealthy. So you can't control them with money. You can't control them under most circumstances with media if they're powerful in the media. So the tool that's used to control them is obviously blackmail. And when you're looking for ways of blackmailing people, I think pedophilia is one of the few remaining holds available. In fact, I've sometimes joked in some of my articles that, you know, if you're somebody who's a rising politician who wants to really become an important political figure in our society, maybe the best thing you can do is to commit some horrific crime, have it all videotaped, and then make sure that videotape gets in the hands of certain powerful people in American society. Because with that videotape in their hands, they would know that they control you. And they would certainly do everything they could to advance your political career. And a perfect example of that is John McCain. I mean, John McCain, when you look at his background, it's unbelievable. I mean, the things in his background that have been documented that clearly were being used to control him and blackmail him. I mean, certainly explain why he was so incredibly popular with the media and why so many efforts were made to give him powerful positions in American society. And so, you know, again, you might want to take a look at the articles I've written on Pizzagate, but I went through all that stuff, connected Pizzagate with John McCain's blackmail and with the Jeffrey Epstein ring, And I think they're complete continuity. And that's why I think there's a very good chance Pizzagate is probably true.
I also agree. I think there was so much stuff in those emails. And those people were also doing weird things. And when I say weird things, it's like, you know, I suppose everyone throughout their life does something that's sort of risque or odd, or that they look back on and think, God, what did I do that for? But when you saw some of the parties that those people were attending, where they were doing that weird spirit cooking and those people lying in baths of what was like congealed blood, pretending to be dead as people spooned it into their mouths, you know, and these people were doing that as if it was normal. You know, if me and my family were, we're going for a day out, there's an art exhibition, you know, at the local gallery, and we turned up and there was a naked woman pretending to be dead, and we were told to, you know, spoon some syrupy blood off our body and eat it, we'd be kind of like, yeah, this isn't for us, it's a bit weird, let's back away. But all these people were like, oh, let's have another spoon of the blood. what you people think this is normal? So when you see that going on and they don't mind being photographed doing that, you have to ask, what would be the stuff that they do that they don't want to be photographed doing? And that's always a step beyond, because I don't want to be photographed at one of those spirit cooking things. I'd be like, no, I'm leaving this, it's weird, I don't want to have anything to do with it. But if they will be photographed doing that, what's the stuff that they do behind closed doors? So I think there is probably a lot of truth to that. And the way the media was desperate to sort of shut it down as well.
Exactly.
There's certain things that the media, you know, you can get away with saying on sort of certain platforms and sort of more sort of wacky conspiracy theories, like the one where this planet is actually an alien tree farm and all mountains are tree stumps that have already been harvested and we're just insects waiting for the next harvest. And there's loads of videos like that. No one's taken them down. I'm sure if that was true, the videos would be taken down. But Pizzagate was very quickly stomped upon. Shambolics gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, Ron's American Prada series has become essential reading. I look forward to each new article released every Sunday. Special thanks to Ron for providing audio versions. Bravo, bravo, bravo. Thank you so much. Glenn19 gave $2. Thank you very much. Said, Mr. Unz, do you believe Israel should be destroyed? This can be done simply by a one-state solution. I believe Zionism is not only not nationalism, but the antithesis to it. Its goal is to destroy all other nations.
Well, I mean, Israel really has such a horrible criminal record right now. I mean, you know, again, take for example, very thoroughly documented. Take, for example, the attack on the USS Liberty, you know, which was basically almost 60 years ago, an American vessel sailing in international waters was attacked in an unprovoked way by the Israeli military, who killed or wounded more than 200 American servicemen. And it was all covered up by the American government. I mean, they intended to kill everybody in the ship, sink it with no survivors. Now, if you're the United States, you know, the most powerful nation in the world, if somebody attacks your ship, kills your servicemen, it was the greatest naval loss of life America had suffered since the Second World War. Under normal circumstances, America's retaliation would have been so overwhelming that other countries in the world would have learned a lesson not to do something like that. But instead, the American government under Lyndon Johnson was so heavily co-opted and controlled by the Israeli government that we covered up the entire thing. In fact, the surviving servicemen were more or less almost threatened with death if they ever told the story. So it took about 10 or 15 years until the story even came out. It's all totally documented right now. Nobody can deny it. But I mean, what we're talking about, when a country goes around and attacks the ships of the most powerful nation on earth and does things like that repeatedly, and probably was involved in the assassination of JFK, as we discussed at the beginning, I mean, we're talking about a country that is behaving in such an incredibly reckless way that at some point, one of those examples of recklessness will probably come through. Take, for example, the attack on Iran. Iran possesses an enormous arsenal of long-range ballistic missiles, including hypersonic missiles. When they were exchanging attacks with Israel, it's clear that Israel's anti-missile defenses had no chance of stopping most of these Iranian missiles. The Iranian missiles hit exactly where they were aimed. So, I mean, we're talking about if America attacks Iran and begins, you know, severely damaging the country, destroying some of its cities, destroying some of its sites, I think there's a very good chance if the Iranians feel that they're going down, they would unleash their missiles and destroy Israel. I mean, for example, one thing that, you know, people pointed out is the Iranians don't have a nuclear weapon, but their missiles could be used to destroy the Dimona nuclear reactor in Israel, releasing all the radioactivity, which would basically destroy the state of Israel. In other words, the whole area would be filled with radioactivity. So, I mean, you know, again, with the Israeli government under Benjamin Netanyahu doing everything possible to persuade America to launch an all-out war against Iran, the result of that might be the destruction of Iran, destruction of the United States, but very likely also the destruction of Israel. Regarding a political solution in the Middle East, it's a very difficult problem. It's not a subject I feel I have a great deal of expertise in, but it seems to me most of the people I know who seem to know that region well and have a good knowledge of it do believe that probably a one-state solution with the Palestinians and the Israelis living together probably is the best possible option. I mean, it's very clear that the current system doesn't work and that, you know, again, the fact that the Israelis maintained a siege of Gaza for about 10 years, refusing to let any food or medicine, almost any food or medicine into the place, which, you know, provoked the Hamas raid that, you know, started all of this thing. I mean, that's really just an outrageous situation. And now the Israelis, for example, under Netanyahu, are trying to use this opportunity to perform an ethnic cleansing of the West Bank to drive out all the Palestinians from the Gaza area and the West Bank and the neighboring countries, and then settle all of it with Israeli settlers. So, I mean, it's just really the Israeli government is not only doing things like, you know, massacres and genocides and atrocities that are very evil, but they're also very, very stupid. In other words, it's so self-destructive a policy on the point of the Israeli government. If the Israeli government were run by very evil people, but less self-destructive and stupid people, they certainly wouldn't be doing what they're doing right now. So, you know, again, if a war breaks out in the Middle East involving Iran, I think there's a very good chance the end result of it would be a bombardment of so many Iranian missiles towards Israel, it would mean the destruction of the state of Israel.
That's a very interesting take. Glenn 19 gave another dollar and he said, every Jew that finds their way into Japan only ends up undermining it. Jake Adelstein and his work dramatically reducing the power of the Yakuza were big funders of nationalist groups. Now with Noah Smith and his recent book, Weeb Economy, only in Japanese, makes the case that the Japanese people must change. Well, thank you for that. Thin Red Lige, $5. Thank you so much. And he says, Mr. Unz, why is it that Jews want to destroy national cohesion in all of the nations? Is it simply a case of competition or is there something else behind this?
Well, again, it's probably a mixture of various different things. In other words, obviously, you know, if you're a cohesive, very small minority, like a Jewish group, one thing that could obviously be very problematic for you and your influence in society is if the large majority began to become more cohesive itself. So in other words, there's obviously a strong incentive for a small cohesive group to try to weaken the cohesion of the larger groups in society so that they can compete more effectively. And the truth is also, for example, you know, a lot of the history of Jewish activity in the world has been very biased and one-sided. So, for example, a lot of Jews, probably even a very large majority of Jews, believe things about the history of the world that simply are not really true or very, very one-sided. In other words, you know, if Jews and non-Jews, like, for example, Jews and Palestinians, have been involved in tit-for-tat actions over the years. But if the media presents a very one-sided propagandistic approach, many Jews might, you know, have a very distorted view of the situation. So, for example, in the United States, probably a certain fraction of Jews have a view that non-Jewish white Americans oppressed them, mistreated them, tried to destroy them in ways that really much more propagandistic than real. And so, you know, much of these Jewish actions against, for example, a white majority population might be viewed by the Jews involved, the more sort of agitated Jews, as being retaliation. But it's retaliation probably for many events that never really occurred or that were very much distorted. In other words, you know, it's the sort of thing when two countries are at war, there's often a lot of propaganda on both sides. In other words, each side's military troops are told that they were in the right, they are being mistreated horribly, they are suffering the atrocities on the other side. It's obviously a way to motivate your own side and make them much more coherent and dedicated to each other in the competition with the other side. So I think to some extent, you know, even though we're talking about a situation that isn't involving explicit warfare, there is a certain amount of ethnic warfare going on in countries. And ethnic warfare sometimes uses the same tools of propaganda and media that actual physical kinetic warfare does. So that's probably much of what's really been involved.
Well, thank you very much. Ghost Dogman gave $2 and said donation. Thank you very much. And Sally gave $5 and said thank you, Mark and Ron. Well, thank you so much, my dear. Poit gave $25 and said donation. Thank you very much. And Jay Bradley gave $15. Thank you so much. And said Johnson's was in the pockets of the Jews. He covered up the attack on the USS Liberty by Israeli killing 130 plus Americans. They're responsible for more white deaths. And we shouldn't be afraid to say it. Well, thank you so much for that, Jay. And we covered that issue a few moments ago. Well, that brings us to the end of the Super Chats and to the end of the show. And I'd just like to say a huge thank you to Ron for joining us tonight. Ron, you've been an amazing guest. And this has been like, you're sort of like talking to an encyclopedia. It's fascinating. And your answers have probably, you know, I could have probably gone on for another couple of hours, but we're not going to do that. But thank you so much for being here. Would you like to have a final word before I shut things down?
Well, again, thanks very much for having me. It's certainly very interesting to discuss these issues and, you know, present them in a way that hopefully will get the word out. And, you know, regarding, for example, the original subject of the talk, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I mean, I think it's very important that some of these ideas be much more widely presented on the internet. And it's unfortunate that most podcasters are extremely reluctant to get anywhere near this issue. So I certainly appreciate the fact that you've given me this platform.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great, great show. I would always love to work with you again. And I'm sure if anything big comes up, I will be inviting you back to talk about it. It's been wonderful. I'd just like to say a huge thank you to Ron. And I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who donated so very generously. And also another massive thank you to everyone who was part of this show, whether you were one of the 400 to 500 people who tuned in live or whether you're one of the people who shared it, donated, whatever you did to help it to get on its way. Thank you so much. I'll be back same time next week with Mike Enoch from TRS. And I'll be back later this week with the Nationalist A team on Sunday, pre-recorded video on Friday. We've got one last super chat from Scaredy Cat who said, hi, Ron and Mark, best wishes for $8. Thank you so much. And that does bring us to the end of the show. And if you want to make a donation after the show's finished, you can continue doing that through Odyssey by hitting the donate button at any time, or you can send money via the crypto links. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you to Ron. Thank you to everyone who donated. And most of all, thank you to everyone who's part of this wonderful community. Love you all. Have a great night. And I'll see you same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you, everybody, and good night.